Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Kof Ched Amar Aleph, 7 lines down. The Gemara is continuing to discuss Gilgul Shvuah. We were looking at yesterday the sources for Gilgul Shvuah and the extent of Gilgul Shvuah. Here the Gemara comes out with an explicit question, Ad Heichan Gilgul Shvuah. How far can it go? Meaning that you already have him in a position where he has to take a Shvuah. What other items can you ask of him? Because you could throw in anything then. You could ask him any question. You could force him to take a Shvuah. Are there any limitations on Gilgul Shvuah? So I'm Rabbi Yehuda Amar Rav, seemingly not. Damar lehi shavali, shein avdiata. You can make him take a Shvuah that he's not your slave. It says, Hau shmute b'shamtinan leh. If he says to another individual or claims that another individual is a slave, then we put him into shamta, we put him into nidui. Titanyo, because we have a baraita, akore lechaveiro eved, Yehei bin Nidui. Someone who calls his friend a slave goes into Nidui. Mamzer, if he calls his friend a Mamzer, Sofeget Arbaim, gets Malkot. Rasha, Yored Nimole Chayav. If he calls him a Rasha, he goes down with him, he can fight with him down to his livelihood. So we'll go through each one of them. Seemingly here that there's some relationship between what he's doing in terms of calling his friend some derogatory term and the punishment that's associated with it. So most of the Rishonim, you can see it in Rashi, a little bit you can see it in Tosafot, are pointing out that there's a Midah, Keneged Midah over here. The first of which is that if you call the individual an Eved, that's someone you're saying that they're not part of Klal Yisrael, that they're really a Kanani, they're not really Jewish. Therefore, Yehebi Nidui, Nidui is the excommunication where he is segregated or separated away from the Klal. So he tried to make this person an outsider, therefore he is made into an outsider, through this nidui. Now, the Rabbeinu Tam points out over here, you see from this, that whenever the Gemara says that you have to put someone in nidui, or they're deserving a nidui, does not happen in memela, does not happen automatically. That you actually have to put them into nidui, and that's what it says here in the Gemara. Haush mudei mishamtinan le. That individual, you put him into shamta. It's not that he's automatically b'shamta, but Beit Din has to actively put him into shamta or into nidui, excommunicate him. So the next one is Mamzer Sofeget Arbaim. Calls his friend the Mamzer, he gets Arbaim. Here, in all likelihood, this is Malkot Midrabanan and not Malkot Deoraita, even though he might be in violation of a lav. Whether it's Motzi Shemra, whether it's a lav Lotonu, that you're not allowed to call people names or attack them through their past or things that they have done wrong. So there are lavim that you are over when you do this, but all of them are lavim Shem Bahen Masim. It's a lav shein bo maaseh, which isn't deserving of malkot. So the malkot are unlikely, even though you're in violation of a lav, to be malkot deoraita, except for the sheet of Rabbi Yehuda, who believes that you get malkot for lav shein bo maaseh. But otherwise, we're talking about sufeget arbaim, means malkot midrabanan. Now, why that is? Tosfot over here suggests that the reason is because, chena korele chavero mamzer hu omer shchavero avar belav. That if a person says that his friend is a mamzer, then he's saying that he violated a lav. Lefikach sofeget arbaim kedino ver b'lav. Therefore, midah keneg midah, he gets arbaim because of the lav. Now, well, that's interesting but difficult because the status of mamzer comes from the illicit relationship of the parents, not from this individual himself. Yes, there is now a lav for him to marry into the kahal, but the main problem with the mamzer is the fact that his ichus, that he's born of an illicit relationship. The problem with the Sheet of Tosfot a little bit is that the Mamzer is just a product of his environment. He is not the one who violated it. And therefore, to say that because you're calling him a Mamzer, you over Balav. Now, the truth is that if he is a Mamzer, there is an Isur Lav for him to join the Kaal. So maybe that's what's associated with it. Or the illicit relationship of the parents produced the Mamzer. Generally, it has to do with the Chiyuv Karet. Sometimes it's a Chiyuv Mitat Beitin. But we know that Chiyuv Karet also come with Malkot. And therefore, maybe even the father, when he calls this child as Mamzer, he's also saying the father is Chayav Malkot. So that's a way to explain the Tosafot. The easier or better way to maybe to explain this is to say that when he calls him a Mamzer, then he's Pogea Begufo. He's hurting him personally, which is he's no longer now able to marry into the kahal. Therefore, we go after his gufo, we give him malkot. So that's the first one was more about his standing, and therefore the punishment is about his standing. You weren't part of Klal Yisrael, nidui, you won't be part of Klal Yisrael. Here by mamzer, it has to do with his status, but the real impact of his status is he's not allowed to Now marry, he's not allowed to be begufo, you've been bogea, and therefore the punishment's bemakot begufo. The last one was rasha, yoredim al chayav. Now when he calls him a rasha, yoredim al chayav, you see Rashi here says, kolamar zo ain beit din is kakim. Says beit din doesn't intervene over here, because you don't see a punishment from beit din. Shamto and malkot are punishments that are executed by beit din. Over here, yoredim al chayav is a permission for almost vigilante justice here, and says that beit din doesn't get involved. Aval hu mutar lesanoto, Rashi says you can hate him. Vaf lema'it parnasato, and you can also cut his parnasa, ulered leumanato, and to go after his livelihood. Meaning that you can hurt him professionally, you can try to wreck his business, meaning that you're allowed to intervene to do this. The reason being, and again here, it seems to be once again that it's a midah keneged midah, which is that when you call this individual a rasha, you make people will no longer want to do business with them, will no longer want to interact with them. You're giving them a shame where they are no longer trustworthy. They are no longer able to engage in business. And therefore, the midah keneged midah is that we allow the other individual to yoredim al chayav, to go after him. Now, there are a number of nafkaminos with the rasha. First of all, it's mutar l'sanot et rasha. It's mutar to hate a rasha. Even though in general, we're not allowed to hate, but you can hate the rasha, or at least the ma'asim of the rasha. And there might be other ramifications in terms of saving him or taking care of him. And so when you call him a rasha, people are not going to want to do business with him. People are not going to want to extend themselves to help him out. People are not going to save him in certain situations. So the midah keneged midah is just the opposite, that you're allowed to hate him, and you're allowed to hit him, and you're allowed to go after his parnasah, after his livelihood, which are all midot keneged midot. What's interesting is that Rashi and Boba Metzia and Daf Ayin Aleph Amud Aleph, on the same expression of Yoredim al chayav, brings down all of these items, including hitting him, or hating him, or going after his parnasa. And over there, Rashi says he's very uncomfortable with this, because why would the Beitin, why would the Chachamim give you permission to be Nokeim v'Noter? And therefore he is uncomfortable, at least with the last piece here, which is going after his parnasa. That he feels already is Nikama, and that you can't do. L'sanoto, to hate him, or l'hakato, which are derivatives of someone being a rasha, that he is more comfortable with, even though I could see the same thing there, where you could say that that's lo tikom v'lo titor. It's one thing for Beit Din to take action against an individual, midah keneged midah, here, in a vigilante way for the individual to take revenge through acting towards him the way that this individual acted towards the victim, it seems very difficult. So Rashi at least quotes that in Baba Metzia. He seemingly is only talking about the harshest of this, which is going after his parnasa, ruining his parnasa. But the other items he seems to be okay with because they are less vengeful, and therefore he was okay with them. But again, here's a midah keneged midah, that the status of rasha ruins this person's social standing in terms of his ability to do business, to be a part of the community and be beneficiary of the community's social structure. So therefore the midah keneged midah is that this individual, you treat him in that same manner. So already from that you see that you can't make a claim like this for Gilgul Shuah, because if you extend yourself that far, you're already stepping into bounds which involve punishments for calling someone this. We don't let people just say what they want to say about other people. You have to be careful about how you speak. You have to be careful about the accusations that you raise against these individuals. So again, we say there's a line that's too far. Even though there might be monetary ramifications here, the truth is that there might be, if he's really his slave, then there are monetary ramifications. But we're not going to allow an individual to do that unless there's at least some circumstantial evidence that there is a claim. You can't make a claim without having some basis for that claim and then all of a sudden call somebody a slave, a rasha, or a mamzer. Those are all claims that are serious, have significant repercussions, and therefore if you're going to make that claim, it better be on sound footing and not just simply, Gilgul Shvua, I'm just going to throw anything out there. El Omer Rova, how far can it go? Yeshavali, Shinodanim Keretli be'Eved Ivri. Pray, take a shvua that you weren't sold to me as an Eved Ivri. Where it says, Hi, Tanata Maliotahi. Over here, that's a good claim. That's a fair claim. That's a monetary matter. which says that you owe me a certain amount of work, or the other way around, which is you have to pay me money because you didn't show up and I purchased you. So here there's a real monetary claim. And from the other standpoint, there's no denigration of the individual just because we call them an Eved Ivri. Call him an Eved Kanani, that's a significant denigration of the individual. Mamzer, Rasha, all of those are very negative terms and descriptions. Eved Ivri is just the fact that you've rented yourself out. This person rented out their output to this individual. It's a relationship of work. The fact that he's an Eved Ivri just means that we have a relationship of I paid you up front and now you need to work for me. But that's not necessarily negative in terms of his standing. Therefore, it's a good tana, mimona itle gabe, because he has a monetary claim here. And that monetary claim we have to take seriously. What's the question that's allowed in a Gilgul Shuvah? Of course it's allowed in a Gilgul Shuvah, like any other monetary claim that he would have, that should be allowed. So when it says, Rava the Tameh, Rava the Shitato, Tosafot back on Tet Zayin Amud Aleph quotes this Gemara to say that when Rava made this statement, it wasn't just Lei Velo Svirle. That when Rava says that this is the din of an Eved Ivri, it's not that he's saying, oh, this is the way that they view it. I don't hold like that. Tosafot proves in this Gemara that Rava holds of his own Shita, which is Dama Rava, Eved Ivri, Gufo Konui. That Rava we saw back on Tet Zayin Amud Aleph said that an Eved Ivri is not just a leasehold. There's a gufo kanoi. You have some real ownership inside of the Eved. There we discussed, it may not be exactly like an Eved Knani, where he's treated like property, and there are property rights. We said whether it's because his guf becomes like a mashkon, or whether he has additional rights. But over here, that makes a difference, because if gufo kanoi, then this is not just simply a monetary claim. There are ramifications to the monetary claim vis-a-vis the standing of this individual. Because now when he's an Eved Ivri, he's not simply, oh, I'm working for you. We have a poel boss relationship. Here you have a master-slave relationship, which is a very different relationship. So when it says, Yochi anu karka, that is karka. Meaning that once you say that gufo konoi, that translates into being karka. That's what happens with an Eved Kanani. Once he's deemed as gufo kanoi, he becomes or has the status of property. So over here too, when you say the Eved Ivri, gufo kanoi, that makes him into karka, or the equivalent of karka. Now, nobody suggests that it goes as far as an Eved Kanani, that he has a din of karka, and that the kinyanim of karka would necessarily work over here. But it does have a additional status, which is that not only is there a monetary relationship here, there's also a isur of sort relationship between the Eved Ivri and his adon and his master. So if it's karka, then I already know that you can do Gilgul Shua karka. That was mentioned explicitly in the Mishnah, that you're allowed, if you have a shua on metalim, you can force a shua on karka. So what's so significant that you can force a shua on an Eved Ivri? If you can force it on karka, then you should be able to force it on an Eved Ivri. Ma'u the tema, what I would thought, karka hud abde inshed mizabne b'tzino. People transact in land in quiet, in a hushed manner. They don't make it a publicity, or they don't want publicity surrounding it. So mita de zavin lele kala. Just because he sold the land doesn't mean that it was public or obvious. That is because the seller of the land is worried about selling the land. In their day, that was the last thing you did, was sell your land. Your land was your status. Your land was your stored value. It was what you gave over to your children. It was something that had permanent standing. It didn't get lost, didn't get stolen. It was a way to feed your family and make a livelihood. So land was so significant that selling land was unusual. And if you were selling a land, it usually meant that you were under monetary duress. And that means that people would start to question your reliability in transactions or in borrowing of money. So when people sold land, they did it in a quiet way. They didn't publicize it. This goes against the Gemara in Baba Metzia, who suggests the other way around, that when it comes to selling of land, it's a very public event, and it's something that's newsworthy. So many of the Mishonim differentiate, which is a nice differentiation between the seller and the buyer. For the seller, his vested interest is that it stay as quiet as possible. For the buyer, it's the opposite way around. His vested interest is to be as public as possible because he wants to establish his ownership over here and that there won't be a claim against his ownership. So you have competing interests over here. One who wants it to be quiet and hushed, the other one wants it to be as public as possible. So therefore, you could see either one playing out, depending who prevails in the situation, if the seller or the buyer prevails in which way it goes. But hi, I mean, either the zavin, when it comes to the selling of an individual, a slave, kala idle, that's something that is always public. That is something that is well known because it really relates to the status of this individual. And therefore, everybody gets that news or it's well known what happened with this individual. And so therefore, you would think maybe there, Gilgul Shvuah won't work because if we don't know about it, then it must have not happened because it otherwise would have been public. Kamash Falan, that we let you do a Gilgul Shvuah even in that case by the Ibn Ibri, even though it should have been well known. If it's not known, if he has a valid claim here, a monetary claim, we're going to accept it. So now, as we mentioned yesterday, the Balei HaTosafot give a very loose definition, but try to define where it is that you're allowed to do Gilgul Shvuah. He says, Dafka b'safek sheish lanu l'chush k'tzat. Has to be at least something where there's a doubt, where there's some reason, a reasonable doubt. Kagon, naselo shutaf, or aris. If they were previously partners or sharecroppers. So as I mentioned yesterday, from the Balei HaTosafot, it makes it sound like in order to do Gilgul Shvuah, you have to have either articulable suspicion that there's some reason for you to believe that there are questions about the activities or behavior of this individual vis-a-vis you and that they might owe you money, or the context, which is that if you are in a partnership or you did have a relationship of a sharecropper and owner, in those relationships, there's likely to be altercations over monetary matters. And then when you do a Gilgul Shvuah, that's not unreasonable to ask the person to take a Shvuah regarding those matters because these are situations or circumstances that usually lead to altercations or friction between the parties. So that's what Balei HaTosafot say in the end. Gilgul Shvuah is not just an open forum, free-for-all, but rather it has to have at least some semblance of guidelines, which is either, again, suspicion, articulable suspicion, or context that makes sense that someone asked for Shvuah in that case. And now, move on to the next Mishnah. The Mishnah itself is difficult to understand, and then the Gemara will attempt to clarify and explain the Mishnah. It says, Kol Nesed Damim Be'acher, something that is money somewhere else. Kevin Shezoch Azeh, once this one takes possession of it, Nitchayev Zeh Bechalifav, the other individual becomes then obligated in its chalipin in the exchange. Ketzad. So now the Mishnah gives an example. And seemingly the example should relate to what was said in the first lines of the Mishnah. Hechlif shor bepara. Someone is doing an exchange, a barter transaction, in which one party is selling a shor, and one party is selling a para. In essence, they are exchanging a shor for a para. Och chomor b'shor. Or similarly, when you're exchanging a donkey for an ox. Kevin shezoch hazeh. Once one party takes kinyan over one of the objects, the other party then becomes obligated. You do not need a kinyan on both sides here. You simply need one kinyan, and that one kinyan then affects both parties or both items. So if you have someone selling a shor and the other person selling him a para, if the bala para now takes or makes a kinyan on the shor, then that automatically makes it that the bala shor gets the para, that the other side of the transaction is now effective, and you become obligated in the item. Now, how to explain? It's not clear, because here you're using pronouns. Whenever you use a pronoun, sometimes it's not clear who the reference to is in the pronoun. The simplest way to read it is, once the mocher, once he takes possession, whatever it is that is being used for the kinyan, then the konen now becomes responsible for the mocher's property, or for the item that he purchased. So that's why there are two zehs here. One zeh refers to the seller, and one zeh refers to the buyer. So when the seller gives something to the konen, once he takes possession of it, he becomes now responsible for the property of the mocher. So what it means is that he's responsible is that the item is still sitting in the seller's property. If something happens to that item, or so it gets ruined or it dies, it's now the problem of the buyer and no longer the problem of the seller. The buyer is now responsible for that property because it's his. And if it's his, anything that happens to it will be his problem, not the seller's problem anymore. Right, so that's one way to explain it. The other way to explain it is that Kevin Shezachaze Nitchayim Zeh B'Chalifav is referring to the same party, which is that once this individual makes the kinyan, let's say it's the mocher, gives over the kinyan, then Nitchayim Zeh B'Chalifav, he becomes responsible for the Chalifav, meaning that he is now obligated to follow through on the transaction. He can't back out of the transaction anymore. Or you could say it the other way around, which is the buyer. Once the buyer takes possession, he's obligated to make payment now because he can't back out of the transaction. Meaning that this is the threshold by which you can't turn back on the transaction. And that's the way to explain it. Tosfot over here spends time on a machlok between Rav and Levi in the Gemara Baba Metzia with regards to Kinyan Chalipin. When you're using this Kinyan Chalipin, whose item is used in the Chalipin? Is it the sudar of the koneh or the sudar of the makneh? Is it the handkerchief of the one who is buying or is it the handkerchief of the one who is selling? So Tosfot over here points out that the language favors Rav's position. Says Rav Nechashapir Igar Sinan. Rav, who says that you use the kelav shel koneh, that you use the buyer's item, then Shapir Igar Sinan came and shezachazeh nitchayev zeh. Once the other individual has it, then the koneh becomes responsible. So that once he gives over, the koneh gives over his property to the mocher, then the koneh becomes responsible for the item of the mocher that he just bought. And so therefore the word zeh and zeh being used again makes sense. Kevin she kana zeh. Once the mocher took the handkerchief of the koneh, then the koneh becomes responsible for the property of the mocher. He says, according to Levi, who says that the property used here is that of the makneh, the zeh and zeh seem superfluous, because once the koneh takes possession of the makneh's property, he becomes responsible for the makneh's property. But that means both actions are done by the koneh. The koneh is the one who takes the handkerchief from the makneh, and he's also the one who's responsible. So why would you say the word zeh twice? And therefore he says there were alternate girsot that only had the word zeh once to deal with it. He says, even if you have the word zeh twice, he says you can still explain it in the Shita of Levi. But just know that that machloket exists in Kinyan Chalipin in general. Whether Kinyan Chalipin is using the handkerchief of the buyer or the handkerchief of the seller, Rav, who says that it uses the handkerchief of the koneh of the buyer, seems to fit much more nicely into what's being said here, because when a buyer's handkerchief is given to the mocher, that's what's said here. Kevin shezachazeh, once the seller takes the handkerchief of the buyer, the buyer now becomes responsible for whatever was being sold. He's now the owner of whatever is being sold. And that's the way that we first explained that phrase. And that's the easiest way to explain it. And again, it's more supportive of Rav. Tosafot, you can see, takes care of Levi either with a different girsa or saying that you could fit it into this girsa. And that is really what the Rabbeinu Tam says, is that even if you have the word zeh twice, it can be referring to the same party, not necessarily the other. All right, now the Gemara says, Chalipin Mainihu. What exactly is the Chalipin, the item that is used in the exchange over here? Kinyan Chalipin comes out of a Pasuk in Rut. Perek Dalet Pasuk Zayin. Zot Lefanim B'Yisrael Ala Gula V'Ala Tmura V'Kayim Kol Dovar Shalaf Ish Nalo V'Natan L'Reyehu V'Zot Atuda B'Yisrael. So here it describes some sort of transaction about Gula and Tmura. Gula seems to be redemption or purchase. Tmura means an exchange. L'kayim kol davar. How do we make it permanent? How do we make basically gmira tadat? Shalaf ishnalo. The individual takes off his shoe, v'natan re'ehu, and gives it to his friend. One of the parties takes off his shoe and gives it to re'ehu. That's a machlok between Rav and Levi in the Gemara of Metzia, who's taking off his shoe to give it. Now what's happening here is that his shoe is being given as a kinyan chalipin. Clearly his shoe is not the purchase price. Clearly his shoe is not what he's using to buy the object with it. It is simply representative of the transaction. So the gemira tadat comes because you're using some sort of representative item to say that you take possession of this is an indication that we finalized the deal. Let's go shalaf ish nalo. In the origins or in the beginning, it was done through a shoe. So now over here, when we're doing a kinyan chalipin, you have to use something that is equivalent to the shoe. The way that the Gemara describes it is a sudar, that it was a handkerchief or a head turban that was used as the exchange or the item. It's a personal item which you give up. But again, the personal item is not being used to buy. It's simply a representative item that shows that we are engaging in the transaction and finalizing the transaction. So what the Gemara says over here Chalipin Mainihu. What exactly is the representative item in this Mishnah? We have Kol Anaseh Damim Bacher, Kevish Azachazen, Itchayv Zeh Bechalipav. Then anything that becomes or has seemingly here monetary value somewhere else, it is can be used to acquire. So the Gemara assumes that the Mishnah is speaking of Akini and Chalipin, and they want to know what exactly is this item, Kol Anaseh Damim Bacher. What is this? So the Gemara says, Matbeya, a coin. So what it says is a coin which is used as money in other situations. Kol Anaseh Damim Bacher. Over here is not being used for its monetary value, but rather for Kinyan Chalipin. It's replacing the shoe. Whatever you would use a shoe for, now you're going to use a coin for. Shma Mina. From this you would conclude, Matbeya Naseh Chalipin. That a coin can be used for Chalipin. Again, which is a machloket, but from here you would conclude that it does. We paskin otherwise, which we're going to see at the end of the sugya here, that ein matbeya naseh chalipin, that a coin cannot be chalipin. But the Gemara's havamina now is, the way to read the Mishnah is, kol naseh damim b'acher, something that is used as money in other currency in other places, can be used here as a kinyan chalipin. And if it's used as a kinyan chalipin, kevin shesach hazeh, nitchayev zeh b'chalipav. That if the person takes a kinyan on the coin, as a kinyan chalipin, then the parties are both bound and they become responsible for each one of them for one to pay and the other one to take possession of the item. So Amar Rav Yehuda, no, that's not what it means. This what it means is kol nishom b'damim b'acher. Anything that you would have to assess its value in order to do an exchange. In other words, what he's saying is that if you were doing a barter transaction, you would have to assign a value to this object. Or the other object in order to do the exchange. Therefore, or in essence, what he is saying is all metaltalim. All metaltalim, which in of themselves don't have inherent value, but they have value once you assess, they can be used in a barter transaction or a kinyan chalipin. If I give you money, you know exactly how much the money is worth. If I give you metaltalim, you have to assess what they're worth vis-a-vis or relative to, whether it's another object or relative to money. They do have inherent value. It's just that their value is not obvious on face. The value is not obvious. By coinage or by currency, you know exactly what value you're dealing with. Right. When you deal with metaltalim, that value is not as obvious. According to most, it does not be here that you actually have to assess the value of it. It has to be something that the value of it would be assessed or could be assessed. It's not something where we say, if you assess the value, you can use it as chalipin. If you don't, you can't. But here, it's simply that the fact that it could be assessed or would be assessed, that's what gives you the right. So the way that you would differentiate between these two answers is, the first answer says we're using a coin for the kinyan chalipin over here. The second answer says we're using metaltalin for the exchange. So now the Gemara says, kevin shezachazeh nitchayev b'chalipin, deganami. So the Gemara says that this second explanation seems much more plausible than the first explanation because of the example brought by the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, ketzad. What's the case of chalipin? Chiflif shor bepara, ochomor beshor. Shma mina, that it's seemingly we're talking about chalipin of items of metaltalim. We're not talking about chalipin to deal with money. We're dealing with chalipin that are objects themselves, metaltalim themselves, and that's a shor and a chomor. So now, the Gemara says, umay desalik adat en miikoro. Now, what we originally thought was that fact that it was a coin and not metaltalim. Dematbea naseh chalipin. That we thought that a coin could be made into a kinyan chalipin, my ketzad. Then how do you explain the Mishnah? Meaning that the second explanation is so good, now a question, we brings into question, what was the havamina to suggest it was a coin? In conclusion, Rav Yehuda said it was all talking about metalklin. And then we go to the second half of the Mishnah, and you go, you know what? That's very supportive of Rav Yehuda's position here, that it was talking about metalklin, because that's the example given by the Mishnah. But originally the Gemara proposed that the chalipin in the Mishnah was a coin. So now it says, oh, you can use a coin for chalipin, ketzad. You exchange the para for a shor. What does that have to do with the first part of the Mishnah? The second half has nothing to do with it. So that's what the Gemara wants to know. What's the ketzad then? Hachi kamar. This is how you would have read it. Perot nami avde chalipin. Not only can you use a coin for chalipin, but you can also use perot for chalipin. Ketzad. How is that? Echlip basar shor bipara. Or besar chomor bishor. You can exchange the flesh, meaning meat, of a shor for a para, or the basar chomor bishor, in that you have a way to exchange items, even though they're not money, or they're not currency. So based on this, you have here a description in the beginning of the Mishnah says that you can, through money, do a kinyan chalipin. And the second half of the Mishnah is saying not only money, but also payrot, also other items. Hanicha the Rav Sheshet. That works well for Rav Sheshet. Damar, payrot avdei chalipin. Who says payrot have the ability to generate chalipin. Elo the Rav Nachman, damar payrot avdei chalipin. The payrot cannot make chalipin, ma'ika the meimar. How do you explain this whole sugya? So now, according to Rav Sheshet, again, the Havamina makes sense. I have a coin that I can do chalipin with. Not only with a coin, but even with payrot. And that's Ketzad. I have the Basar Chamor with the para, or the Basar Chamor with the shore. It reads very easily according to that Havamina. According to Rav Nachman, who says that payrot cannot be used for chalipin, how does he explain the second half of the Mishnah? The first half of the Mishnah says you can use a coin. Second half of the Mishnah says I can use a shore and a par. But he's telling me I can't use payrot. So then what is the transition from using a coin to the second half of the Mishnah? So Hachi Kamar, this is what he says, Yesh Damim Shehein Kechalipin. There are certain times where monetary value is like Chalipin. Ketzad? Hechlif Dmei Shor Bipara, O Dmei Chamor Bishor. If you give the value of a shor for a para, or the value of a chamor for a shor. So my time, huh? Why does this work at all? Savar laki Rabbi Yochanan. He holds like Rabbi Yochanan. Damar, Dvar Torah Ma'ot Konot. This goes to a machloket in the Gemara and Baba Metzi. Again, we'll get there. Where the question is for Metaltalin, what is the Torah's vehicle for acquisition? Rabbi Yochanan says that when it comes to Metaltalin, the Torah tells you how to acquire them, and that is through money. Ma'ot is the primary way to acquire Metaltalin. Ah, we just saw in the Mishnah, Meshicha is the primary way to do that. As we noted back there in the Gemara, that's only Midrabanan. Matam, Amru Meshicha Koneh. Why do they say Meshicha is the vehicle for acquisition? Gzeira Shema Yomar Lo Nisfu Chitecha Baliyah. To protect against this problematic outcome, which is that if we say that Meshicha is not necessary, but simply money buys you the object, then the buyer could pay the money to the seller, and have yet to take possession of the item. It's sitting in the seller's property. He owns it, but he hasn't taken possession of it. The problem is if something happens. Now, a fire breaks out in the mocher's property. What's his incentive to take care of this? Absolutely nothing. He doesn't own it anymore. It's the other guy's property. So Chachamim wanted to prevent such matters. And so they said you need a kinyan meshicha in order to prevent that. Not only do you have to own it, but you have to take possession of it to finalize the transaction, thereby incentivizing the mocher to take care of it because the transaction is not final. It's actually, in order to do that, or in order to incentivize the mocher, they also have to give him something, which is that now the mocher has the right to back out of it. I mean that in the giving him the responsibility for the item, if you don't have a kinyan meshicha, they also gave him the right now to back out of the transaction. So he has some upside, because if the price goes up, he can back out of the transaction and ask for the higher price. But with that comes the responsibility for the item until the kinyan meshicha is done, until there's possession. So it is not all to the detriment of the seller. The seller also gets a benefit out of this. And that's the balance the Chachamim used in order to protect against these eventualities where the buyer's property is going to be sitting in the possession of the mocher and the mocher is not going to take care of it. So that's what Rabbi Yochanan says. Rabbi Yochanan says that min haTorah, money would work. The Chachamim imposed that you need a kinyan meshicha in order to finalize it. So even though when you pay for it, technically min haTorah, the transaction's over and you can't back out of it. Nevertheless, the Chachamim said you need a kinyan meshicha in order for that to be the threshold of finality. And that has implications, again, with regards to nisrachu chitecha baliyah, as well as the ability of the mocher to back out. Very, very interesting Tosafot. Tosafot says over here, why when we say that we're worried about nisrachu chitecha baliyah, we're worried about the fact that your chitim are going to be burnt, meaning that the buyer is going to have the ownership without the possession. Why don't we say the other way around as well? When the buyer gives his money to the seller, if we don't say the transaction is final, then when the money gets lost or something happens to the money, the seller is going to say, that's your money still. We didn't do a kinyan meshicha. We didn't do a kinyan meshicha. Your money was in that fire over there. It's all lost now. There's no money left. How come we don't worry about that scenario? So Tosfot says, in Achanami, we should have had to worry about it, but, Yesh Lomar, Teicha Daleka Lamecha Shechol HaPachot Shea Mocher Kishomer Chinam. He says that when you give money to the seller, he becomes at least a shomer over the money. He may not own the money, but he has responsibility for the money because he becomes a shomer. Since the money is in his possession, but he doesn't own the money yet because the Ginyan Mashiach hasn't taken place, effectively the Mocher becomes a Shomer. He has someone else's ownership in his possession that he is responsible for. Even if he's a Shomer Chinam, he's still a Shomer. And that means that he'll be responsible for anything besides onus, anything besides unforeseen or not preventable circumstances, but anything else he's going to be responsible for. And therefore, he will be held accountable, even though he doesn't yet own the money, because the Kinyan Meshicha is holding the transaction in abeyance. So that's why Tosafot says that they were willing to go to the Kinyan Meshicha and not worry about the Ma'ot, because the Ma'ot are protected because of the status of Shomer, of the Mocher, whereas the Chitim are the other items where the buyer owns them. And they're in the possession of the Mocher, he has no responsibility towards them. Since he has no responsibility, he'll let them burn. So that's the difference between the monies and the item that he is selling. Now why? Milta de Shkiach Gazru Barabonon. Things that are commonplace, the Rabbanon goes there. Milta de Lo Shkiach Lo Gazru Barabonon. Things that are uncommon, the Chachamim were not gozer, a Kinyan Meshicha, or Metakin, a Kinyan Meshicha. So now, what you have here is a circumstance in which he's trying to acquire something through ma'ot, through money, and we're saying that this is not your classic case of Kinyan Ma'ot. Since it's not your classic case of Kinyan Ma'ot, therefore, it won't be subject to this Takanat Chachamim of Meshicha. So Rashi explains over here, and generally this is, most of the Rishonim agree with this. There are some Rishonim who don't agree that this can be a mechanism for acquisition. And it goes back to the Machloka that we saw earlier in the Masechta with regards to Kiddushin in the same manner, which is, the individual sold him a shor. A sold B a shor. So now B owes money to A because of the shor that he bought. So now there's an outstanding debt that is there. A comes back to B and says, you know, listen, you owe me this money. You have a loan from me in essence because you bought the item, you have yet to pay for it. Instead of paying me that money, I want you to give me your para. So in exchange for the demay shor that you owe me, I want your para. Or in essence, the forgiveness of the loan is the consideration for whatever he's buying. I'll buy the para and we'll forgive the loan. So that's the nature of this transaction over here. That's what it's saying here, that you can exchange demay shor be para. The money owed for the shor that was purchased, you can exchange that for a para. Well, that's basically the equivalent of saying I'm buying it with money. That's ma'ot konot. And ma'ot konot are subject to a kinyan meshicha midei rabbanan, according to Rabbi Yochanan. So what the Gemara says here is, the din is bifurcated. In normal cases of transactions, what's a normal transaction? You take cash, you give them cash, and then you get the item. That transaction, Chachamim instituted a kinyan meshicha in order to finalize the deal, ma'ot will not suffice. On the other hand, in a case where the transaction is premised on the forgiveness of a loan, meaning that the purchase price is done by forgiving an outstanding debt, that is not your common transaction. It's an unusual transaction, and therefore it was not captured by this Takanat Chachamim. Because Chachamim, in general, is a principle the Gemara uses all over Shas, is that Takanat Chachamim, Gzerot Chachamim, only relate to common and normal situations. If you have an outlying or unusual circumstance, their Takanat Gzerot generally does not cover that item. And so, since it's a Mil D'Lo Shchiach, there is no Kinyan Meshicha. And that's what it means, Ma'ot Konot. So now, according to Rav Nachman, even though you can't have a kinyan chalipin with peirot, nevertheless, what's the Mishnah saying? The Mishnah is saying in the Havamino, you can use a coin as chalipin. But if you use vehicle for acquisition as being the coin, then aren't you under the rubric of ma'ot konot? If you did the transaction through purchase price, then the purchase price itself or the giving of the money would not finalize the transaction. You would need a kinyan meshicha. But the case that says is, sometimes the money is not being used as money, which is that normally a coin, when it's given as money, that's the ma'ot konot, and it's subject to kinyan meshicha. Sometimes money is used in a manner that it's more like chalipin than it is money. What's that? That's the case of forgiveness of a loan. The case of forgiveness alone, it won't be subject to the normal rules of money acquisitions because it's an unusual case, and therefore you won't need a kinyan meshicha. And that's what he's saying over here, that once you've given the money, meaning that you forgave the loan, the transaction is done. That's already a quasi Kinyan Chalipin, we'll call it in that way, that exchange of the consideration for giving the loan is what creates the end or the Gemiyat Hadat or the finalization of this transaction. And that's the way that Rav Nachman will explain it according to Rabbi Yochanan. Ula Reish Lakish, Damar Mishacham Mefereshet B'Torah. According to Rish Lakish, who says that Mishicha is the primary way to do a kinyan, and that's Min HaTorah. That's because V'chi Timka Memkar Miyad Amitecha Ukano Miyad Amitecha Davar Ha Nikne Miyad Liyad. Something that's passed from hand to hand, that is a kinyan Mishicha. Hanicha Yisavar Lakir Reish Sheshet. Rish Lakish can work well according to the Shita of Rav Sheshet. Damar Perot Avdei Chalipin, because Perot can act as Chalipin. Then he can answer like Rav Sheshet and explain the Mishnah according to Rav Sheshet. If he holds like Rav Nachman that Perot cannot act as Chalipin, and according to Reish Lakish, coins or money do not create an acquisition, but my Mukila. What's the explanation of our Mishnah anymore? You can't use it as a regular Kinyan Chalipin because Perot can't function as a Kinyan Chalipin. Can't be forgiveness of money, because even in a normal monetary transaction, Reish Lakish believes that it's not a kinyan. Kinyan comes out of Mishicha, not out of money. Al-Gurchak Rav Sheshet Sfirli. For Reish Lakish, he will have to hold like Rav Sheshet. He cannot hold like Rav Nachman. Alright, now, we have to go back because there is a major machloket over here that Rashi discusses. Rashi brings down his explanation. At the end of his explanation, he says there was an alternate view or girsa over here, but I think it's wrong. Of course, if Rashi brings it and he thinks it's wrong, the other Rishonim would think it is right, or that's why there was an alternate girsa. And the truth is that the majority of the Rishonim believe that the Shita or the girsa that Rashi rejected is the right girsa in the Gemara and the proper way to read the Gemara. There's a third Shita of the Rabbeinu Tam, which we'll explain in 1 second. So now, the question revolves around what is the machloka between Rav Nachman and Rav Sheshet. Nachman and Rav Sheshet over here say that, can Perot be used in Chalipin or not? When they use the word Perot, what do they mean? What does that mean? That Perot can be used for Chalipin or Perot cannot be used for Chalipin? Perot has different meanings in different contexts. Sometimes Perot means fruit. Sometimes Perot can mean output or the derivative of. You could say pre-behemtucha. It's the offspring of your animals, but it's still referencing to animals. It's not referencing to pre-real fruit. So over here, when we use perot, what is the meaning of the word perot? So Rashi says, kol midei delohavi kli peri karile. Rashi says, anything that's not a utensil is called a pri. The difference between Rashi, according to Rashi, the difference between a pri and a kli is that a kli has utility, meaning that it can be function, it does something for you. Whereas a pri is something that maybe you consume, something that you get benefit from, but it's not a utensil that you use to do something or some activity. And therefore, anything besides a utensil is called a pri. That includes animals, that includes food items, that includes anything besides a functional kli. The reason being, and Rashi says, the machloket between Rav Nachman and Rav Sheshet and the Gemara in Baba Metzia is about the word now. When we say that, shalaf ish na'alo, what is the meaning of the word na'alo over there? Does na'alo mean just like a na'al, just like a shoe is a kli? So too, you can only use a kli for a kinyan chalipin. That's the shita of Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman says kli works. Peirot, any other item, does not work. On the other hand, Rav Sheshet believes that when we say that na'al works, it's any metalin. It doesn't mean a kli in particular. Just means not karka. It means something that can be handed from one party to the other. But it's not necessarily a kli. And their machloka revolves around this na'al. The na'al from the Megillat Rut. About whether the na'al is narrowing the scope to be exactly like a na'al, meaning a kli. Or is it just telling you that it has to be metalin? And that's the machloka between Rav Sheshet and Rav Nachman. Based on that, that's what Rashi says over here. The machloka then is about what works for chalipin or not. Kalim, everybody agrees, works. What are we questioning? Perot. Perot, the definition of perot is that it doesn't have an inherent definition. The definition is anything that's not a kli, is a pri. And as the Rashi says, that's the machloket here. The problem with that explanation, and Rashi himself notes that, which is that the Gemara now, in explaining or questioning the shita of Rav Nachman, turns out that the question on Rav Nachman is not only in the Hava Mina, but also in the Maskana. The Gemara at first said that the kinyan that we're using in the Mishnah is a kinyan chalipin of a coin, of a matveya. And then it said ketzad. So what's the case of ketzad? How do we explain ketzad if you're going to tell me that the coin is the vehicle for chalipin? So the Gemara says, we explain that hichlif basar shor bipara. He exchanged the flesh of the shor for a para. And in doing so, then you have a kinyan chalipin. That is problematic for Rav Nachman, because Rav Nachman says you can't use perot. Basar shor is a pri. So how can you use that for kinyan chalipin? So Gemara asks the question. Then, what about Rav Yehuda's answer? Rav Yehuda's answer is that we're not talking about a matbeya, but we're talking about tzchol anishom, some sort of metaltalim over here. So now, of course, Rav Nachman over there could explain that Rav Yehuda is saying a kli, and that we're using a kli. But then, what does he do with the ketzah? The ketzah says, you can exchange a para for a shor or a shor for a para. Once again, I'm using peirot. If I'm using peirot for Rav Nachman, that's problematic. And therefore, according to Rashi, the question of the Gemara is not only on the Havamina, but also on the Maskana. How is Rav Nachman going to explain the ketzah in the Mishnah? The ketzah in the Mishnah is using a pri. By definition, it's using a pri because it's a shor and a par. Those are animals. Animals are a pri, and Rav Nachman doesn't allow you to do chalipim with it. So the question on Rav Nachman is both according to the Havamina, as well as according to the Maskana of the Gemara. And that's what the Gemara is trying to clarify over here. The one difficulty is that when the Gemara says over here that, oh, the answer is that it's basar shor bipara, the truth is it doesn't matter if it's basar shor. Even if it was a shor and a para, it would still be problematic for Rav Nachman. And you can see that in Rashi. Rashi says basar shor, v'kol shekein shor chai. Because for him, that's considered to be a pri. If it's a pri, you can't use it. If you use basar shor, then certainly a shor, which has utility and function, right, is more like a kli, right? So that would work. But that means that the question then is not on Rav Nachman, doesn't really matter. If it's a shor, basar shor or a shor chai, for him it's a problem. And that when the Gemara said here, basar shor, it was giving you one example, but it's true by a shor chai as well. So that's the way Rashi explains the Gemara here, that the machloket is, a fundamental machloket is whether anything besides a kli can be used for a kinyan chalipin. Rashi brings in the end, v'yesh mishanim sugya shel shmua zu b'shita acheret. V'amri plukta Rav Nachman shedu b'peire dafka. Their machloket is about fruits, period, food. V'lo b'shar metaltalin, but not other metaltalin. Says, v'lav miltahi. Rashi says, there's no way you can explain it like that, because in the Perek HaZahav, in Bava Metzia, when it talks about the machloket, as I mentioned before, it says you compare it to a nal. So you have a nal, either a nal is a kli, or a nal is metaltalin. How do you ever come up with any distinction that says everything works except peirot? Where does that come out of the now? And for that reason, Rashi rejects that explanation, which is that their machloket is a narrower machloket only about food items or peirot, not about metaltalim. Kalim, obviously, everybody agrees, work. Metaltalim, now, according to that sheet, that would work as well. It's only about peirot themselves that the question arises. Rashi rejects it because of the derivation of the limudus from the word now. And there's no way you can explain now to exclude peirot, but include metaltalin. And so then Rashi wipes it out. Again, I told you that almost all the other Rishonim disagree with Rashi and accept this view of the machloket in the Gemara. And that is because then it makes it easier to understand the Gemara, which is that only in the Havamina do we have a problem for Rav Nachman. But in the Maskana, we have no problem for Rav Nachman. Because the Maskana is that the Mishnah is talking about a kinyan chalipin with an item, some sort of metaltalin. Ketzad, what's the example? Shor bepara or para beshor. That works for Rav Nachman then as well, because Rav Nachman says metaltalin you can use for chalipin. It's just peirot that you can't use. Where was the problem? The problem was in the Havamina for Rav Nachman, because in the Havamina we said it was a kinyan chalipin with a coin. And then what's the ketzad? The ketzad says basar shor bepara. So now we're talking about peirot. Basar shor is food. There, Rav Nachman will say that that doesn't work as kinyan chalipin. That's what the Gemara is trying to clarify. How does Rav Nachman fit into that section? Because that's called a kinyan chalipin with peirot. And Rav Nachman doesn't accept a kinyan chalipin with peirot. But that narrows the question of Rav Nachman to just the Havamina, not to the Maskana. As well as when you read the words basar shor bepara, it's literally. It's not basar shor and then also shor chai. No, it's only basar shor. But a shor chai for Rav Nachman is not an issue. Because that's metaltalim. Since it's metaltalim, then you don't have to worry about it. And you could use it as a kinyan chalipin. The only question is when you define it as basar shor, there you have an issue for Rav Nachman. And that's why these other Rishonim explain it in this manner. What do they do with the question of Rashi about a nal? That says a shoe. The answer that's given by the Rishonim is either that a nal is a kli, but a kli in the sense that it has duration to it. That it's an asset or an item that stays around for a long time. A shoe doesn't just disappear. It doesn't have a shelf life. It can be used for years. And therefore, what is being compared to the shoe is it has to be dover amit kayem. Something that has shelf life, that has lasting power. as opposed to food. Any food item has a limited shelf life, especially when you don't have refrigeration. Therefore, that's how you exclude payrolls from the word na'al. So that's how the other Rishonim deal with it, as well as the fact that they say that na'al just means something with utility. So now, if you say na'al is something with utility, then that can include live animals. Live animals have utility. They're used for work. They are productive in that manner. And therefore, you could include them and exclude payrolls or food items, which do not have what we call functional utility. They have utility in the fact that you can eat them and you can get hanah from them. But they don't have utility in their ability to do other things or to be used towards other means. And therefore, that's what the distinction of na'al is. And that's how those Rishonim explain it, despite the questioning of Rashi. There is a third shita, and that shita is of the Rabbeinu Tam. The Rabbeinu Tam says that there are actually three different types of acquisitions here that are mentioned in the pasuk. And the argument is only about one of them. He says, if you think of it, see this pasuk, it says, Zot lefanim b'Yisrael, ala gula, va'ala tmura, chayim kol davar shalaf ishnalo. It says, gula is a transaction, a kinyan kesef. That's a normal transaction in which you're purchasing an item for money. There's tmura. Tmura is a barter transaction. Then there's a third transaction, which is a kinyan sudar, which is shalaf ishnalo, where you use a representative item. He says the pasuk is speaking about three different types of kinyanim. There's a kinyan of kesef. Kinyan kesef works according to everyone. That's not an issue. Rav Nachum and Rav Sheshet, they both agree that geula or kinyan kesef works. Then you have ala tmura. Tmura is a barter transaction. There, everybody agrees as well. Both Rav Nachman and Rav Sheshet agree that alat mura, a barter transaction should work, and it doesn't matter what the bartering items are. That works. The only question is, shalaf ishnalo, the kinyan sudar. That's where they have their machloket as to what works as the representative item. So the Rabbeinu Tam actually narrows the scope of where the machloket is by saying that barter transactions are out of this machloket between Rav Sheshet and Rav Nachman. Until now, we've said basically barter transactions and kinyan sudar are synonymous. They're the same thing. But Rabbeinu Tam says, as he bifurcates and says, that barter transactions is by itself. That's tmura. That you don't need kinyan chalipin for, because in a sense, it's similar to a monetary transaction. You're exchanging values and supposedly things of equal value. Kinyan sudar works in a different way, which is that it's a representative value. It's not about its value. It's about representing the kinyan or the exchange or transaction between us. There, the item used is important. Because in a barter transaction, you just need to know values, and that's it. That's fine. So it doesn't matter what it is, as long as the value matches. By a kinyan sudar, what you use is important. Because it's not about the value of the item, it's about what the item represents. And since it's what the item represents, it's got to be something that has representative value. But the machloket here is, do payrot, metaltalim have that type of representative value, or do they not? And that's the machloket between them. You could read the Rabbeinu Tam into the other Rishonim, or into Rashi, either one. From the Rabbeinu Tam, you get more clarification about how the Kinyan Sudar, Kinyan Chalipin works, which is that you are using a representative item to generate the transaction over here. In doing so, you're saying to the individual, take this item as a representative way to seal our deal, or to show that you've acquired whatever it is from me and now I'm obligated to you. If you use money, the problem with money is money has two representations. You're trying to use it here as a kinyan chalipin to represent an object that's being used in the kinyan chalipin. But money itself is also representative of value or currency. And that is through the printed, you know, today we have printed bills, we have coins that are minted. The picture and that which is minted into the coin gives it its going value or its currency value. And so the coin itself is also representative of value because it's a currency. If the government takes that item out of circulation and says it's no longer a valid currency, that representation is lost and people can't use it as a currency anymore. It's actually more today than it was even in their day. In their day, at least the items had inherent value to them. Today, our coinage or our bills, our money has no inherent value or a very minimal inherent value. It's all representative value. So therefore, you have a tension here that when you use a coin, we don't know the person who's using, receiving the coin and making the kinyan on the coin. We do not know which representative value or representative status is he focused on. Is he focused on the currency aspect of it? Or is he focused on the representation as a vehicle for kinyan? And because of that, that's why the Gemara concludes that ein matbea naseh chalipin. Coins cannot be used for a kinyan chalipin, because we're afraid that you're focused on the representative value and not on the inherent value of the coin. The same reason why you can't use coins for kiddushin. Because we're worried that the woman is focused on the tzurah and not on the inherent value of the coin. And therefore the tzurah, it can be taken out of circulation. The currency can be voided. And therefore we're worried about what the person who's receiving the money is focused on. And that's what, again, comes out of this idea of kinyan sudar. After to you, like, but the Rabbeinu Tam that separates it out from a barter transaction. Now you can understand why the kinyan sudar has certain issues or limitations or requirements that are different than a barter transaction, because you're no longer talking about value, talking about representation. And when in representation, you have to be sure that the party that's taking it knows what representation it is, or we're sure he's focused on that representation. If he's focused on some other representation, then it's not going to work. And that'll be Ein Matbea Naseh Chalipin, as well as how the Rabbeinu Tam deals with the way to lay out this Gemara and the Machlokes Rav Nachman Rav Sheshet, limiting it to a much narrower scope of issues. All right, now next Mishnah. Rishut Gevoa B'Kesef. When it comes to dealing with Hekdesh, money talks. Rishut Hedyot B'Chazaka. On the other hand, when it comes to layman's transactions, Meshicha or Chazaka is the key vehicle. Amirato L'Gevoa K'Mesirato L'Hedyot. When you say something to Hekdesh, it's the equivalent of transacting with lay people. Tanu Rabbanan. So now Gemara wants to explain this Mishnah. Ketzad Rishut HaGvoa B'Kesef. But explain to me what it means that money is the only thing that talks with Hekdesh. Gizbar Shenatan Ma'ot B'Behema. The Gizbar pays out money to buy an animal. Afilo Behema B'Sof HaOlam. Even if the animal is somewhere else in the world, Kana. He acquires it. It becomes into the possession of Hekdesh. It belongs to Hekdesh immediately. U'Be'ajot Lo Kana. By a lay person, that doesn't work. Ad shim shoch. Until you have a kinyan meshicha, that's because of chitecha nisrufu ba'aliyah. According to Rabbi Yochanan, that's the whole institution of the chachamim, that you need a kinyan meshicha, because we want it to be in your possession. We don't want it somewhere else in the world where nobody's going to take care of it. We want you to have it in your possession. And according to Reish Lakish, that's the key vehicle, the key way to do a kinyan is through a kinyan meshicha. So that explains what it means that kesef can acquire on behalf of Hekdesh, means it acquires wherever it is, or the equivalent to what Rabbi Yochanan would say, Minat Torah, happens with Metaltalin. You pay money, the deal's done, and you own it. That's it, period. And the reason we don't worry about the same problem that we have, Nisrufu Chitecha Baliyah, by Hedjot, how come we don't worry about that by Hekdesh? The answer is that people treat Hekdesh a little differently. When it's their friend stuff, they're like, doesn't matter. With Hekdesh, everybody in a sense has a vested interest in the communal property. The person made a donation. He wants the donation, he wants the item to go to Hekdesh and to be used by Hekdesh in the end. And therefore he has some vested interest in taking care of it, and we worry less about this issue of Nisrufu Chitecha Baliyah. And the reason that Hekdesh takes possession of an item anywhere in the world is because Hashem is omnipresent. There is no place where Hashem is relegated to, and therefore wherever it is, it comes into the possession of Hekdesh because of that omnipresence of God, rather than being like a hedgehog where he has a particular location where his possessions are kept or which is his. So that's why Hekdesh can come into possession of an item no matter where it is found. Ketzad, Amirato L'Gvoa K'Mesirato L'Hedjot. What does it mean here that when you say something to Hekdesh, it's the equivalent of transacting by a layperson? Omer Shor Zeh Ola, Bayit Zeh Hekdesh. If you say this animal is a Kurban Ola, this house belongs to Hekdesh, Afilu b'sof olam, no matter where it is, kana, then Hekdesh owns it now. It goes into the possession of Hekdesh. Your simple neder, or your commitment to give something to Hekdesh, is finality. That brings it into the possession of Hekdesh immediately. Be'ejot, lo kana. Ad'shim shoch, b'yachzik. By a hejot, that is not the case until you do a kinyan shicha with the case of a metalton like the shore, or yachzik, he does a kinyan chazoka with the house. So you have to have a formal kinyan in order for that to be finalized. Now, the truth is that the oral commitment that you make to Hekdesh, or a statement that you make to Hekdesh, is binding. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah darshins from the Pasuk and the Gemara in the Nedarim as well, that Motzeh Svatecha Tishmor, that once you make commitments like that to Tzedakah, or commitments to Hekdesh, they are binding on you like a neder. Now, the Gemara is going to go through the case and show how Hekdesh is the beneficiary here of having the upper hand in all cases, which is, he purchased the item for 100 zuz, and there wasn't enough time to redeem it until the price went up to 200. Hektesh owns, let's call it an animal, they sold it to somebody for 100 zuz. By the time the guy shows up to pay for it, it's already gone up in price to 200 zuz. Notein matayim. Hektesh has the upper hand over here, and since you haven't paid for it yet, you have to pay the higher price, and Hektesh gets the higher price. The transaction is not finalized because the buyer cannot back out, the layperson can't back out of the transaction, but Hektesh can now charge the higher price because that you never finalized the transaction. You never paid for it. My time, what's the reason? When you pay for it, you get it. Until you pay for it, you don't get, or you don't redeem from Hektesh until you paid for it. What happens if he did a kinyan mishicha when it was worth 200? But by the time he shows up to purchase it and to redeem it, it's only worth 100 now. So now you would think, based on what we said before, you should only have to pay 100, not 200, because the deal was not finalized. We're talking about Hektesh, notein matayim. Hektesh gets the upper hand, you have to pay based on the original price. My time, Lo yekoach hedyot chamur b'chekdesh. Because Hektesh should be no worse off than a layperson. In that circumstance, a layperson, the deal would have been done because you had a kinyan mishicha. And even though kesef wasn't paid, the kinyan mishicha makes the deal final. So Hektesh should be no worse than a layperson, and therefore the kinyan mishicha over here should finalize the transaction, and you'll have to pay the higher price, meaning that at the time of the kinyan, the price, not now when you come in to redeem it. So Hektesh gets the upper hand. If prices go down, they say, ah, we're like a layperson, and mishicha finalizes it. If prices go up, we say we're Hektesh. We depend on money. Till you pay your money, the appreciation is in our possession, not in your possession. Padove matayim. So now, what about the other way around? He paid 200 zuz. V'lo yispik l'moshkol, ad shamad b'maneh. But he didn't come to take possession of it until it was only worth 100 zuz. Notein matayim. He still has to pay the 200. Or he already paid the 200. He's not going to get anything back. He's not getting any rebate over here. He's stuck. Why? Because Hektesh cash works. Cash is a finalization of the transaction. You paid the 200, now it's yours. When it depreciated in your possession. My time of an atanakis has become low. You pay money, it's yours. So now it's yours. When it went down in price, it went down in your possession. What happens if he paid the 100 zuz to Hektesh already? And he didn't yet come to take it. He paid for it, but didn't take it in his possession until the price is already up at 200. Mashapada padui. What's done is done. Wow, that doesn't sound like what we've seen until now. No. Until now, we would have said Hektesh has the upper hand, and he would have to pay 200 now. He paid 100 already. Now it's gone up to 200, he should have to pay another 100 to get the item. That's what we would have thought. The Gemara says, no, mashapada padui. Whatever he's done is done. Vein notein ala maneh, and he only pays 100. Amai. Why not? Hachanami neima lo yekoach hedyot hamachomor mechekdesh. Why should Hektesh be worse than a layperson? In this case, if a layperson paid money, and then the value changed, the layperson could back out of the transaction because there is no kinyan mishicha yet. Since there's no kinyan mishicha, he can back out of the transaction and say, I don't want to sell it anymore because it's now up to 200. You have to pay me the higher price, otherwise I'm not going to sell it. So why don't we give Hektesh those same rights and say that they can back out of the transaction now? Otu hejot lava misha parakoi. Because even by the hejot, it's not a free-for-all. You were thinking here, oh, there was no kinyan mishicha, so therefore it's not a final transaction. That's true. But as the Gemara in Bava Metzia, the Mishnah in Bava Metzia tells us that the person already paid money for it, and there was no kinyan mishicha, and he wants to back out. Technically, he's allowed to back out because there was no kinyan mishicha. Nevertheless, the Mishnah says, a person who backs out of such a transaction, misha para, the one who took retribution or cursed the Dor HaMabul and the Dor of Migdal Bavel, should curse such a person. If a person doesn't stand by their word and carry out the transaction that they committed to, there's a curse. Now, technically, again, he could do it. He's allowed to back out of it because the finality only comes with kinyan mishicha. But if he makes that choice, just know that we're not happy about that choice. We're not happy about you backing out of that transaction. And in a sense, we're going to curse you. We're going to say that Hashem should take retribution on you for not standing by your commitment. So therefore, the Gemara says, even by a layperson, it's not just like, oh yeah, you can walk away from the transaction. If you walk away from the transaction, there's a lot of negative stuff that happens. And therefore, we can't say, oh, Hektesh should be like a hedge oat. Well, by a hedge oat, it's not clear that he can really walk away. He can't technically walk away, But we do everything in our power to encourage him not to, and to tell him he's going to be cursed if he does. That means he's really bound by the transaction. If that's the case, then by Hekdesh, where money really is binding, and the only reason we would give him the right to back out is because by a Hedjot, Meshicha is the final transaction, and not the money, and therefore they should have more rights here. Truth is, by Hedjot, we don't really give them those more rights. We don't really let them back out. They can, technically, but we don't let them. And so too, by Hekdesh, we're not going to say that Hekdesh can back out of the situation. Out of those four cases, this is the only one case where Hekdesh ends up on the short end of the stick. Otherwise, all the other cases, we give them the upper hand. And that is, again, because the only reason here to give them the upper hand is if we compare them to a layperson. What we're saying is that by a layperson, the fact that, Kevin De'ediot, any yacholach zorba below Misha Parah, since that joke cannot reject the transaction or back out of the transaction without suffering the consequences. So for Hekdesh, we're not going to make it l'chatchila that they can back out of such a transaction, because a hedjot, we would not encourage them or really let them back out of such a transaction. So now, Tosfot over here makes a couple of points. One is, Rim Tomar, over here, when it says that he bought it, he did a Kinyan Meshicha for 200, and he didn't pay before it went down to 100. He said over here, the reason why he has to pay the 200 is because Hekdesh should be no worse than a hedjot, and Kinyan Meshicha should finalize the transaction. Tosfot says, forget about that. Why don't you just say, Amirato l'gvoach and Mesirato l'hedjot? That when you make a commitment to Hekdesh, that's a lock-in. Over here, you committed to pay 200. So once you've said you're going to pay 200, you're going to be held accountable to pay for 200. You're locked in. Why do we have to use this whole logic by the hedjot? It's enough that you just said that you're going to pay 200. That should be a commitment. The Ishlamar came in b'taut haya, k'mo hacha, sh'olei sabur sh'ishtane ashar. Over here, where it's a mistake, and he didn't think that the market price would change so dramatically, lo avi k'misira l'hedjot. It doesn't have that status. What does the vote suggest is that amirato l'gavoah only works like a misira l'hedjot, where there's a rational and rational or expected movement in the pricing of the item. But if there are dramatic moves in the pricing, or something changes so much, then a person did not anticipate that, and when he says something, he didn't mean to commit to it, because he clearly, if he knew that the price would move this much, that would not be considered to be a commitment. In a cases where the market price of the item is not well known, gagon marganita, like a diamond, like precious stone, gomer bedato afilu tishave yoter. Person sells it for whatever price that's there, even if the price will fluctuate. Share kmo ken misupak shemeshave pachot. Since there's so much uncertainty surrounding the pricing, he doesn't know if it's going to be up tomorrow, it's going to be down tomorrow. He doesn't know. So he's gomer bedato, and he says whatever he says, he lives by it, and he's committed to it. And therefore, his amira over there is a commitment that he can't back out of. On the other hand, when you're dealing with items where their value is well known or can be assessed, over there, people will not sell or not commit to something way below value. And therefore, over here, by the case where he bought the shor from Hekdesh and committed to 200, the next day it's worth 100, it's clear that he did not anticipate that, and he would never make a commitment. That is a mesira or a mira b'taut. That's clearly a mistake, because the shor's value is well known in the marketplace, and therefore if he assessed it totally incorrectly, then we're going to say that's a taut. Inami yesh lomar, k'shesham ota b'pachot mishavya mitkaven lebatel l'hekdesh. Or you have to say, in a case where it's undervalued, he was going to give up to Hekdesh. Aval hacha lo nitkaven lebatel klal. And the person knows ahead of time that he's selling for a lower price to Hekdesh. He's getting the short end of the stick. He's willing to do that because he sees that as a donation to Hekdesh. The other end, where he buys it from Hekdesh at its true value, and then later it changes, and now he's way overpaying for it. Over there, he's not mivater and saying, oh yeah, I want to make a donation. He didn't want to make a donation. He bought it at value. Now that it's all of a sudden worth less, he wants to buy it at value, not at its lower price. So that's why, for one of those two reasons, Tosfot says over here, Amir Tolda Hekdesh would not work, either because here he's not saying I want to give a donation to Hekdesh, and I know I'm getting the short end of the stick because he wanted true value, or the fact that when you're dealing with items that do not have a fixed value or easy accessible value, there you can say that people are mevater. But in a case where it has a fixed value, people are not going to be mevater if they get the wrong price, especially when the difference is significant. Or you can say here that the case is where he never committed to the payment. You can see that in the Tosfot we have Zakein. He says, Iga demand the mefresh lo diber klum. He didn't say anything. El sheshal le gizbar k'bekama kesef titein li ze'ah chefetz. Said to him, how much will it cost to buy this object? And then he stood up and he took possession of it without making any commitments. So since there's no amira, we can't say that amir told Agdesh, because Mesirah told the head yod. And that's why in this case, Mara had to come to the comparison to lay people, rather than invoke the principle of amira told Agdesh. Tosfot Rabbi Zakein continues and says, Vayikar, the law amrinan amira told the gvoah, elubamash who notain the gvoah. Kagon, short zeulah. When you are the one making the commitment, when you are the one initiating the transaction. And in cases where Hagdesh is dictating the price, or he gives another explanation which is similar in nature, which is, only things that are in your possession do we say the din of Amir HaTol HaHagdesh applies, whereas things that are in Hagdesh's possession, the din of Amir HaTol HaHagdesh is not applicable. Tosfot also over here discusses what we discussed in Gemara and Gittin, that Yitomim have the same right as Hagdesh. Over there, the Gemara and Gittin told us that the Yitomim also get the upper hand in the transaction, similar to what's going on in Hekdesh over here. Tosafot asks that the Gemara over there says that in the case, the last case, the final case that we had here, that the Yitomim get the rights of Meshicha, not like Hekdesh. And so he says, why? Why do they get the right to back out of the transaction where Hekdesh doesn't get that right? He says, V'yesh Lamar, the Lo Domi. The cases are not comparable. The Hotum gave yat maybe do right to dinam kejot. Min haTorah, they really should be treated like lay people. V'imkein einam konim below mishicha. So their real din is with mishicha. So when you say that there's a transaction here of commitment, the guy paid him 200 and he didn't do a kinyan mishicha yet, then if you treat them like a hedjot, then the deal was not sealed yet. If the deal was not sealed, they should get the upper hand in this case. El sheyipu chachamim kocham lasotam kehekdesh. The chachamim upgraded them to have a din like Hekdesh. But in the final case over here, if you treated him like a hedgehog, they would be able to back out of the transaction. So therefore, by a Yitomim, where they really are hedgehogot, we let them have the true din of a hedgehog, and therefore they can back out of it. When we gave them the other rights, that was just an upgrade to Hekdesh. Over here by Hekdesh is the other way around. The core din of Hekdesh, midoraita, is b'maot. If you want to make it that it's mishicha, you're downgrading them to a hedgehog. Over there, we won't do that. Hilkach u'makom efsidan shi yutomim. In case of the loss of yutomim, u'kim ne'adina, we put them back at their core din, which is to be a behedjot. Even though there's a misha para, even though there's a curse there for yutomim, we make an exception and say it's fine. Aval hekdesh midoraita hu demakne bekaspo. But a hekdesh that by din Torah only works with money, rabbana tiknu mishicha l'arvachan, that they gave them the right to mishicha when it was to their benefit, shloi koach hedjot chamur mikoach hedosh, gave the hedjot any yachol zorbo. And therefore, in this last transaction where a hedgehog can only back out if he takes the curse, nukmei adinei bekesef, we leave hekdesh at its core din, which is that of kesef. And that's how he explains the difference between yitomim and hekdesh. Even though we're saying yitomim are like hekdesh, nevertheless, we're saying they're even better than hekdesh, because in this final case, yitomim get to back out of it. Hekdesh does not get to back out of it. But Tosfot says that's because of the starting point or the default status. By yitomim, the default status is a hedgehog. That's what they should be. We upgraded them. So in this case, we won't upgrade them and they'll get that right. By Hekdesh, it's the other way around. Their rights are money. And then we, quote unquote, downgrade them to Hedjot in cases where it benefits them. But over here, where the Hedjot doesn't have full rights, we're not going to downgrade Hekdesh to that right. We're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Chatet Amud Aleph.